Hi, my name is Sarah, and I am an alcoholic. And Billy, thank you so much for Sam actually asked me to come, but he's not here, so we've been corresponding about the time and location. So just thank you. I mean, I've always heard people say that it's an honor to do this, and it really is, because my sobriety date, it's August 15th of 2011, which means I'll have a year coming up in a couple weeks. And, you know, that doesn't put me at the pinnacle of my sobriety or anything, but, you know, I have... In a year, I mean, it's just been a huge, by completely giving myself to this program, it's just been a huge difference already, and I'm excited about what lies ahead, and so it is an honor to be asked to speak, definitely. It helps me get out of my head. Whenever it becomes chip time, I kind of go a little bananas before a chip, you know, I don't like it, I get nervous, but then it's okay, it passes after I get my chip, until it's time for the next chip, and, you know, so this 1 year, it's just been a lot of self-reflecting going on, which isn't good for me, but it's, I've been thinking a lot about like what I was doing last summer at this time versus this summer, and it's just night and day. It's totally different. So my sobriety date again is August 15th, 2011. Just a little fun tidbit. It's the Assumption of the Virgin Mary into Heaven. And I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor other women. And my home group in Richmond meets now. It's on Sunday nights at 6:30, and it's called Speaking of Steps. And it's really big. It's a really diverse group of alcoholics, and I love that. I love all the differences, and because we have that underlying thread, you know, where it talks about like we're a group of people that normally would not mix. It's so true, and I just identify with so many people who I thought I'd never have a thing to talk to about. So it's just been amazing. So I'm going to, you know, follow the format, what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And hopefully, you know, somebody will hear something useful. So, again, you know, I'm new at this, so hopefully, you know, you can fall asleep if you need to. I mean, I'm just here to be of service, basically. So I guess what I was like, you know, I grew up in Charlottesville, and I was a very awkward kid. You know, I've never, for as long back as I can remember, I've never been comfortable in my own skin ever from the jump. I mean, my very first memory, I've just always been very uncomfortable, and I've always, you know, I was very just skinny, and you know, and it's not just that, it was just, I've always had a problem connecting to people. It's like I could sit here and have a conversation with someone, but there's something blocking me or something, and I just couldn't connect. Like there was some kind of screen between us or something. And that was kind of the theme throughout, you know, from then till now, and even now sometimes. But it's like just that problem of just getting into life and just getting to be a part of it, and just always up in my head when people were talking to me. So as a child, I really didn't have that many friends. You know, I grew up in Charlottesville. I had an older brother, and he's here. And I had an older sister, and just like a very tight-knit little family, you know, a mom and a dad that were together. They never divorced or anything. I can't say if anybody's an alcoholic, you know, but as far as like my dad's behaviors and drinking and stuff went, you know, that would be my lucky guess, you know, and that's, I can only say that now just like based on what I know. And I see so many similarities in us and the way we are. And it's funny because I was like growing up, it was kind of for me, like my perception of this was that it was a very explosive household. He had a very bad temper. It was like walking on eggshells for me a lot of the time. I had, like, my stomach was in knots when I was around him. And they talk about this in Al-Anon, like, where I'm powerless over alcohol. Like, they are powerless over the alcoholic. And I remember times, like, if he would come home later than work from work than he was supposed to, and I would just hear, like, the car door slam. Like, I could tell if he'd been drinking just based on the time and just the way the door slammed or something. And I would get this, like, pit in my stomach and, like, my spine would crunch and, oh, God, he's home, because I never knew what to expect. And, you know, there would be these tantrums, and I was just, and I don't know if it's that I was a sitting duck for alcoholism myself or that or everything. I don't know, but I've just always been so inward. I've been a very inward person. It's always been me on me. And gradually as life went on, you know, it just made me more nuts and nuts, you know. But I just never had that many friends growing up. I would have like one or two friends and just really throw myself into my studies. I was a huge reader. I read all the time. And it's because I loved to be up in my head in a fantasy land. And I just loved to fantasize and read these books. And, you know, usually there was a man involved and I'm going to be whisked away and have this romance or, you know, just whatever the case would be. And I would read like Sweet Valley High and those, if y'all remember that. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to, you know, and in my head, I'm like, you know, in this popular clique and just like fantasy land. And, you know, in school, I was just so nervous to talk to people. Just again, that just extreme focus, that intense focus on me. And, you know, I was a good kid. You know, I was really good. Straight A student, you know, the type of kid that teachers would read my papers to the class, you know, so I wasn't making friends that way. But, you know, I never went to parties or anything. And I never, like, went to homecoming or prom or anything like that because I just didn't. And so, you know, just, like, really throwing myself in my studies. And what started happening, I can't remember, I'm trying to think of the time frame, and it was somewhere around 14 and 15 years old, maybe 14 through 16, I don't know, somewhere along that line, like I started freaking my mother out a little bit, and she would get really aggravated with me because I started to do things like I would just be sitting there and just like staring off into space, you know, it's like this, and she would get really angry and she'd be like, Sarah, Sarah, like really loud and be like, what? And that started kind of concerning her. And so I started going to see, that would be like my first foray into psychiatry, you know, to see what's going on here. So I went on medication for that. I've been diagnosed with a lot of stuff, you know. Finally at the end, I got like a great diagnosis. I'm like, I don't have just depression. I don't have just this. I have something major, and then I got bipolar disorder, and I was really excited about that, you know, because I got all these meds for that, and I was so excited. But you know, so I started like my little antidepressants early on. I took my first drink of alcohol. I was like I said, a good kid. What's funny when I look back at my childhood, if you were to ask me, like, when's the first time you had cotton candy? I have no clue. When's the first time I went to the zoo? I have no idea. But I remember the very first house I lived at 4 or 5 years old, like, my first memory is sitting on my dad's lap and having a sip of beer. It was probably Coors Light. I remember, and nothing happened. I didn't catch a buzz. I didn't get a DUI, like nothing happened. But it's just always been weird to me that I have that memory. Like, why do I remember that? You know, it's just like, it's just odd. But then, you know, again, I was just a good student, but very inward, just reading all the time. A little off, you know, I remember, like, it's this time of year, you know, where it's like summer and the kids are splashing in the pool. And I remember we were members of this, like, great pool that was a part of the community. And all the kids, it's like, you know, my brother's really the only person I would hang out with, but then he was off with his own friends, so we didn't get to hang out all the time. And if I wasn't with him, I was just, like, laid up on the bench at the pool next to my mom and just, like, watching these kids splash around and have fun. And my mom was a chain smoker. And I remember, like, one time I was sitting there, like, pretending to smoke her tampons that were in her purse. I was just like, something was just off from the jump, you know. And so my very first drink of alcohol, it was my sweet 16th birthday. But again, like, you know, I don't have any friends, really. I had this one close girlfriend. Her name was Tracy. And I hated her guts. Like, I didn't know how to be a friend. You know, it was, like, constant resentment. Like, you know, it was just this constant resentment. I couldn't be a good friend. I talked about her to my family constantly, and I hated her, but she's the only person that would hang out with me, so I was always with her. What we did on my sweet 16th birthday is, I don't even remember how we got it, but we got a big old plastic bottle of, like, Bowman's vodka or something, and it was definitely vodka, I just don't remember the brand, and then we got a six-pack of a beer. We hid it in her room for days leading up to it, because we couldn't put it in the fridge, obviously, and so the night of my sweet 16th birthday, we played Monopoly, and I remember we started drinking, and I took, like, my first big old swig out of it. It was just, like, out of the bottles and cans, and we were chasing it with the beer, and I just remember just being euphoric, just, like, it was great. I was just, you know, so high, and I don't know, I just remember laughing a lot and, like, rolling around on the ground, and the way and the quickness that we were drinking, you know, I definitely browned out, but, like, my head ended up in the toilet. I was, like, sleeping on the bathroom floor with the spins. She had a bathroom in her room, and, you know, we got away with it, and I really didn't drink after that, but, you know, looking back now, and it's funny, when I'm speaking now, it's, like, all this stuff that's happening, it's, like, I can look back at it now and be like, oh my God, there was such a huge problem. And it's weird to me that it's taken me this long to, but anyway, but the point is, like, I can relate the story now in a way that I understand alcoholism a little better, you know, and I do practice the 12 steps and stuff like that. So I kind of can articulate this in a way that I wouldn't have the first day that I walked in here, is what I'm trying to say. But what was poignant to me about that first drinking experience with her is that really set the pattern for my drinking, in that from that moment, every time I would consume alcohol, and it wasn't in excess to the amount that it was towards the end of those days, but it's just always been a thing of just, like, get it in me. Like, just get the alcohol in me. I don't care. I don't need fruity cocktails. I don't need chasers. I can't stand shooters or wine coolers. I want the most amount of alcohol in the littlest amount of volume, you know, because I can take a lot of volume. And that's something else, you know. When I finally did go to college and I started partying and stuff, it's like I and everybody around me was so super impressed with the amount that I could throw down. And I was so impressed with that. Like, look at me. I'm out drinking this dude. He's 6'5 and muscular, and he's passed out. And look, I'm fine. And it's like, but that's abnormal. I mean, it's very abnormal, and it's terrifying. And, you know, it's terrifying because, like, remember, this whole time now, I've been on meds now since I'm, like, a teenager, so now I'm drinking on top of this stuff. And, you know, because I just, something was wrong. And now I'm drinking, and I go to college. You know, I didn't drink anymore in high school. I might have drank one other time, and it was like that. It was very similar to that. But then I go off to college, and I decided I wanted to go far away to college because, you know, my family just stressed me out so bad. You know, the whole dynamic with the way my dad was and just, like, being and just in that house, you know, it just, him flying off the handle over, like, little things. I was so stressed out, and I decided that I was going to go away to school, and I was going to go out of state. Now, the thing is, like, my parents, it was like a normal middle-class family, you know, so they couldn't afford to just send me anywhere I wanted to go, but I managed to find a university that's out of state that has, like, what we would consider in-state tuition, and it's a huge drinking university. It's been nominated in Playboy for, like, years on end as, like, the biggest party school in America, so that's where I went. And I remember, and I didn't go there because it was a party school. I just wanted to get out of state. And what I remember about that is, like, the very first week, so I got this roommate. They assign you roommates. And I got her, and I was just so nervous being up on that floor with all those girls, and everybody's getting along and talking, and I'm not like them. And I just, people would try to talk to me. You know, I look normal, but I just couldn't. And they would all be going out. They're like, we're going to the bars tonight. Because at this university, it didn't matter. Like, you could show a 17-year-old ID and get in and drink. It wasn't a big deal. You don't even need a fake. But I just wouldn't go out with them. And I just was really into my studies for, like, a week or so. And I remember. And what I remember is them, like, I'd be up studying, and they'd be coming home at, like, you know, midnight and just laughing and hugging each other, and everybody'd had a grand old time, and they're all getting connected, and now they're all going to, like, breakfast together in the dorm room, I mean, in the cafeteria, and I'm just, it's just me on me. Again, I'm just so inward and thinking about myself, and I think that's normal, you know, I think that's normal. I don't know, it's weird. I did decide to finally go out with them one night. I'm like, I'm just going to do that. And I started, it went to $5 drink and drown. You pay $5 to get into this bar, and you drink till you drown. You could just get whatever mixed drink you want. And I remember I was sucking down something blue. I don't even remember what it was called, but it was like, and that would be like my first, like, real blackout. And I mean, it was like, there was no laughing coming home that night. The girls were like, you, and they were telling me all this stuff. I was like, what? And then, like, apparently I walked out of the bar and I passed out in front of, like, a whole, like, gaggle of cops. Just, like, passed out on the pavement. And they, like, I don't know how my friends, like, talked them out of doing whatever with me, but, like, you know, somehow I got home. I don't remember. And I just remember being horrified, and that's, like, kind of where it started. And that this trend would continue, that I would just be like, well, I'm just not going to drink anything blue. Obviously, there's something in blue dye that just doesn't agree with me, and I'm just not going to drink blue things. And, you know, and eventually down the road, I also did that with, like, like tequila. Like, I can't drink tequila. That makes me mean. Like, you know, like that makes me fight. And you know, it was just like always something. Like, I was like, you know, organizing my alcohol depending on what mood I wanted to be in. And like, so I left college after 2 years. I got, you know, I was just having trouble, and I did, like, I had a couple friends. Like, the girls that I was friends with, they drank like me. They definitely drank like I did. They would do crazy stuff like me. They would hook up with shady dudes. You know, we would do all these things that the other women would be like, oh, my God, what's wrong with those girls? And we found it hilarious. You know, we really didn't care. And, you know, I joined a sorority, which I didn't even want to. I don't even know why I joined the sorority, because I didn't even want to be in it, and I didn't get along with it. Like, I didn't not get along with them. Like, I wasn't fighting or arguing, but I was just a loner, you know, because I just didn't know how to relate. Like, I didn't think I was cool or anything, but I didn't know what to do. Like, I've always had a problem just identifying. I don't know. It's like I can't communicate, and it's, again, it's that me. Like, it's me on me, and it's, so what ended up happening is I left college, because I found a boyfriend back in Charlottesville, and, you know, I was home for, like, maybe a summer, and he dumped me, and within, like, a month, and that, it wasn't really a big deal. It was one of those things, but I moved in alone. I'd been living with my parents, so I moved into my first apartment by myself, and I had one close girlfriend in Charlottesville, like, one that drank like me again, and we would do, like, this crazy stuff, and I think back about, I really feel very lucky to be standing here. I mean, just the way I would consume things, you know, I did, I've been hospitalized once during that time for alcohol poisoning, almost had a DUI because I tried to run some guy over, but I cried my way out of it, you know, just doing all this, like, outlandish, weird stuff that, and I thought that was normal. I'm like, well, I'm young, and I'm pretty, and I'm a party girl. Like, I'm finally coming out of my skin. Like, look, I'm finally making friends, and everybody wants to drink with me. They think I'm so fun because of all these, like, shenanigans. And but there were things that weren't so fun. I remember, like, God, one night, like, my friend had to drive me home. I drove this little old red Subaru, and the next morning there was, like, puke all down the side of the passenger row, right, like, where I'd been sitting. Like, I guess I'd, like, puked down the window while the car was driving. But I was just like, I was disgusting. I was disgusting. And I really, yeah, it's just, I don't know. And I would actually say, I had no understanding what, if you were to tell me, like, alcoholic, like, you're an alcoholic, like, once in a while somebody would point out my drinking's not right. And, but if you were to say alcoholic, like, what I pictured was, like, my dad. That's, like, what I thought an alcoholic was. And I'm like, well, I'm not like him. I'm not explosive. I don't, like, my image in my head of what an alcoholic, like, I pictured it to be him. So I'm like, well, I'm not like that. So I'm not an alcoholic. So I just didn't put two and two together, I guess. I ended up meeting my husband, the man that I would end up being with for 10 years. During this whole, like, crazy summer, I mean, just doing stuff like that, I mean, being a bad, it's like I had been this, like, good girl in high school, and now I was this bad girl, and I thought that was great, because, again, I'm in fantasy land, and I'm like, oh, I'm so bad, you know. But, so I meet this man that's going to be my husband now, and I don't know, it's weird, you know, they say how alcoholism is progressive, right? I don't know, I was able to somehow glue the wheels back on, like, you know, my brother had spoken this morning, he said something similar, I was able to glue the wheels on during this time with my husband, like, and not, I still drank, of course, but I wasn't, like, getting consequences, I wasn't going to bars, I don't know, I wasn't doing bad, like, the way we would drink would be considered acceptable, you know, we would just have parties and stuff, but my drinking was always different than everybody else's in that, like, I would suck down five to somebody's one, I was, like, getting drunk before we went out because I knew that I'd just go nuts at the bar waiting for my drink. Like, that used to be my pet peeve. It's like a bartender would take so long and get so agitated, you know, that restless, irritable discontent. And so what ended up happening with that, and again, like, I'm just miserable. It's weird. It's like I thought when I got married, I really thought that's what I wanted. It's like, well, what I need is I need a man and I need to have kids. And this is like, that's to me what a perfect life looked like. And when I got engaged, I got this big old fatty family heirloom diamond, and I'm like, you know, waving it in people's faces, and I really thought I had arrived. Like, I really thought that. Like, look at me, I'm engaged, you're not, you know. It's just like, I don't know, it's just like, and, you know, so we get married, and I start, you know, I can look back now and just see the progression of the illness, like whether I'm drinking or not. It's like, it's not about my drinking, you know. I would love, and, you know, everything now that leads up, like, I would love to stand here and tell you, you know, if I had known what alcohol would do to my family, I would have never known in a million years, but it's what I did to my family, you know, it's what I did, and the alcohol is just, I drank, and it's just what I did. It's what anesthetized me. It's just what made me feel calm and okay, because when I drink, I'm comfortable. It takes the edge off. Like, I need some relief, you know, just from life. It's like everything. I'm just so fearful about everything, and you're looking at me, and even right now, I'm a little more comfortable, and I'm like, how do I stand? Should I be like this, or should I, like I don't know what to do, you know, and everybody's looking at me, and I'm sweating, and it's like, oh my God. But you know, it's like that sensation. But so I get married, and I have a beautiful daughter, and she's 6 and a half now, and she's a little mini-me. She's just, like, awesome. I did not mean it like that. But, like, you know, what I have seen now in my behavior, and again, the more I learn, what's so funny about me getting sober now is I am an educated woman. I have an extremely high GPA. I'm dressed the way I'm dressed. I have a professional job, you know, a home and all this stuff. But I run off of emotions, and I am like my 6-year-old. And if you catch me in dry alcoholism when I have a resentment and I'm being untreated and I'm just all mad and going nuts, I'm like her. I mean, it's like you see this, like, woman that's like a 6-year-old. It's weird. And, you know, now I'm working with women, and I see it all the time, and I'm like, wow, like, that's weird. It's an odd thing to notice. You know what I mean? But so I had my daughter, and I remember thinking, I breastfed her for a year, and I was very strict about not drinking while I was breastfeeding, super strict. And I was miserable and snappy at my husband. That's when I started getting real mean to him. I started getting really mean. And I remember, you know, he would work, and I was a stay-at-home, and I'm home with this baby just breastfeeding all day, and I'm just miserable. I don't have any friends. Like, the only way I can make, because we had moved to a different city now, and the only way I can make friends is if I'm drinking. It's the only thing that loosens me up enough to be able to have a normal conversation with you. And so I'm breastfeeding, and you know, looking back now, like, there might have been some postpartum there, but, I mean, that was untreated alcoholism, I think, the way I was, so agitated because I'm not drinking. I'm not taking any medications because I don't want to breastfeed it to my baby, you know, and it's like, I was a hot mess. You know, he would come home and I would be like, you know, you're late. And he'd be like, you know, if the clock, if he was supposed to be home at 5 and it was like 5:05, I would be bananas. I mean, I just, oh my God, that did not fly with me. And that kind of thing with him just got worse and worse. And he was just such a gentle soul. I have no idea how he stayed with me for 10 years. None. I really don't. And then, you know, I remember one time driving, and, like, here's my attitude. Like, I was a complete spoiled brat, hardcore. And I remember, like, here's this man working, making money so that I can stay home with our baby. I'm living the dream that I wanted. Like, I should be happy, right? But I hate his guts, and I hate being a mom, and I hate that now the baby won't take a bottle, and I'm having to be stuck breastfeeding it. And I remember driving. And that Janet Jackson song, What Have You Done For Me Lately, came on. And I remember cranking it up, and I'm like, yeah, like, what have you done for me lately, you know? And he's doing everything. I'm doing nothing. I'm not even cooking. I'm doing nothing for him but complaining. Well, then, you know, we moved to Richmond for his job, and then we wanted to, like, his family was from Gloucester, and my family was from, like, Northern Neck area, and my family was from Charlottesville. And so we moved to Richmond. And I decide, you know, our marriage is on the rocks, you know, we really need to have another baby. Like, this is what we need. We need another kid, and we could have our perfect family. And it took me a while to convince him, but I did. He finally caved, and I got pregnant. And so I had this son, and he was born normal. He was a little on the small side, and we thought that everything's okay. Like, he latched onto the breast immediately. And again, my pregnancy was healthy. Everything was normal. Normal ultrasounds. And then, you know, what ended up happening with him is, like, he was hospitalized after 4 or 5 months because he had just stopped eating. And I was feeding myself. I was doing everything I did with my daughter. I had a strict diet. I'm drinking these tea, used to make milk, you know, I'm doing all this weird stuff and he's not eating. He'd eat for like 1 minute and pull off and be fine. And I'm getting super stressed out by this. And my mother, she ended up being hospitalized. She had had like some kind of intestinal thing and she got hospitalized at the beginning of that summer. And on the same day, it's actually in the spring, like on that same day 3 years ago, he was admitted to MCV in Richmond and she was admitted to a hospital here in Charlottesville on that same day. So the rest of my summer entailed just going back and forth between hospitals. You know, he was admitted for a long time, and he would come out, and then he ended up going on a feeding tube because, you know, we just had to get food in him to make him grow. And I really thought, you know, I'm starting to go a little bonkers here. I thought, my mom's going to be okay. They're going to fix whatever is wrong with her. She's going to come out, and Doc's going to be okay. We're going to put him on a feeding tube, and he's going to come out, and things are going to be fine. That's when it became acceptable to me and everybody around me for me to start drinking early in the morning. Like in the hospital, people would bring me gift baskets of like little airplane bottles of anything and like Playgirl magazines. And you know, just things like, you know, it became this big thing like we have to entertain Sarah. We have to keep her. She's going to lose it. She's, you know, this is too much stress for anybody. We got to keep her together and we got to keep her glued together. And so and it talks about in our book, like, you know, at some point, you know, the alcoholic process between controlled drinking to uncontrolled, and that was very true for me. And I can't picture exactly when it happened, but it definitely happened. At the end of that summer, my mother passed away, and my son was finally discharged, but not without severe lifelong problems that we're facing. He does not know how to eat or drink orally. He's completely tube dependent on this point. He has a little G-tube. And I was just a wreck. I was so, before he got that G-tube, he had a nose tube. We would have to, like, I would have to, like, swaddle him in a blanket and pin him down with my knees and, like, jam this tube up his nose, that would go in his stomach. And I was his caregiver. Like, I had to do that to feed him. But I would drink beforehand because, like, and I said it was to, like, calm my nerves. And part of that was true. But I really think what was happening there when I look back is that I was trying to separate myself from him because I loved this kid so much with all my heart. And here I'm torturing him. And, you know, I couldn't handle it. I couldn't handle it. And so I would just do it. And, you know, I was just drinking. It was like off the rails. It was just constant. And I started, I made a group of mom friends, you know, because everybody's just taking care of me. There was, like, this swarm of people in Richmond that, like, they heard about this thing with my son and my mom, and I became, like, this hero or something that, oh, my God, this girl's alive, and she's just, like, been through all this. So people just wanted to be around me and be supportive. And so I sucked all these people in, and, you know, I ate up all the attention, absolutely ate it up. Like, I deserve this, you know. I deserve people. And I started going out all the time. You know, I started going out. I started going to bars again. And it's like my composure drinking in college, passing out in front of cops, it was way more composed than me at 33 years old. You know, it was awful. I was drinking like a college girl, and I lost all those friendships because people couldn't trust me with their husbands. I was doing bad things. Something flipped in me, and I did not care anymore, and I started losing all these friends. Everybody's now hearing about me. We step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate, and that's absolutely, people who didn't even know me from a hole in the wall wanted nothing to do about, they heard about me, and what I would have to do is find friends that were, like, I would just have to find bad friends, you know what I mean? Like, I would find, you know, drugs aren't a huge, I've done drugs before, they're not a huge part of my story, though, because I've tried a bunch of different things here and there, but whenever a drug became a problem, I was able to just stop. Isn't that amazing? I mean, I just, like, even if it was something, like, really addictive, considered addictive, it's like, oh, you know, I've been up for 3 days, like, that's not good, and then I would just stop doing that, whatever. And you know, and I've tried a bunch of different things, not as much as some people that come in these rooms, but, you know, if there's a, I would just take whatever, just anything to feel altered. I love to feel altered. I love it. So if there's, like, a drug I missed, it was just an oversight. I mean, I would have done anything. But, like, you know, the one thing I would not do, and here's where I could start seeing a sense that, you know, there might be something else wrong with me, is I've never tripped acid. I've always been firmly against it. And the reason for that is I know how I am in my head. I know how self-obsessed and self-consumed I am. I know this about me. Before I knew I was alcohol, well, and yet before I even knew what this was, I knew that that was not right. And I knew if I ever tripped acid, I'm like, I just was sure I would lose my frickin' mind finally, and I would never come out of it, you know? So that's just why I didn't do that. But anyway, like, you know, so I'm starting to hang out with these shady people and doing all these outside issues, you know, started leading a really bad double life, and I ended up, like, cheating on my husband, and I got caught, you know, and the double life, I would do these things. I was having an affair with this surgeon, and we would, like, meet in a hotel room, and then I'd, like, come home and have dinner on the table, you know. I would, like, have people watch my children. And then I would drink before, because I knew what I was doing was bad, but I just wanted something to feel better. I just wanted to feel better, whatever it was. And I mean, I just went bananas. I mean, seriously, just anything to make me feel better. And it didn't work, you know. I got thrown out of my house, and I ended up moving to the fan. And I tried. I'm like, oh, you know, I'll never do this again. But the truth is, like, by that point, we were sleeping in separate bedrooms, and this poor man that had to suffer through this, you know, he's like, you know, I don't love you anymore, and I haven't loved you for a really long time. He's like, you know, it's just no. So I left, and I didn't. I felt so racked with guilt and so upset by what I had done to him and my family that I really didn't take that much from my house. You know, I really left most of the furniture and the pictures on the wall because I didn't want to alter the look of the house for my children. You know, because I just was so shameful. And I moved to the fan specifically so I could walk to bars. And the schedule was, oh, wait, before this, though, I guess I should mention, before all this went down, it was, like, right after that affair started, like, I threatened to kill myself again. And I was admitted to Tucker's, which is, like, a psychiatric place, for a few days. And they have two sides, like, an alcoholism and addiction side, and then they have, like, the part where just all the crazy people are all drugged up and they shuffle. You know, and that's where I was, because we didn't know alcohol was my problem. So I'm over, like, on this side, so there's no AA meetings coming on that side, and I couldn't stand it. Like, I thought I was going to lose it. Even as medicated as I was, like, it doesn't even matter. Like, the medication does not fix what's wrong with me. It doesn't matter. There's no perfect blend. There's nothing. Because I've tried everything. And so, you know, and I remember coming home from Tucker's, and I think it started to, like, signal in my husband's head that something might be wrong, because I remember seeing the bar at our house, and, like, when I came home, I noticed, like, I walk in, and that's the first thing I saw was there was no alcohol, no nothing, not even any, like, cooking stuff, you know, nothing that would have alcohol in it. And I'm like, what's this? It's like, well, somebody called while you were admitted, and they said, you know, we might want to look at your drinking or something. And I remember laughing. I cracked up, because, like, I'm not going to stop drinking, like, what? Because I knew there's a gas station, like, I just knew that that wasn't going to happen. So I'm living in the fan now that summer, and it's a mess. I have my kids 50% of the time, 1 week on, 1 week off, and I start this plan, like, I'm only going to drink when I don't have the kids. No, I'm only going to drink when I don't have the kids, and then, like, I can drink when I don't have them. You know what I mean? Like, it was just, like, I had this whole schedule out. Now, what happened is I was not a nice person when I had them and wasn't drinking. I was snappy. I was nervous around my son. Like, I was angry about having to do these tube feedings. I mean, so angry with God and just the world. Like, just so resentful that, God, I have to make this formula, and it takes so much time, and I have to mix his little medications, and I have to do all this stuff for him. And so it started becoming a thing where I would drink when I had, whether I had them or not, you know. And I remember we would, like, walk to a park in the city, and I would bring a big travel coffee mug, and I would fill it with wine. And this happened a few times. And we would walk to the park, and I'd have my travel mug of wine. We'd get to the park. I'd finish it, like, instantaneously, practically, and the kids were playing. And I'm like, all right, kids, we got to go, because I would, like, get so agitated, you know. It's like, why did I think to bring more? And the minute we would get back to my apartment, I would think I had lost time, and I would just start chugging wine. It's like I was so in it, and nothing. I just wanted to feel better. That's all I wanted. You know, and it talks about, you know, I have, and I didn't realize, too, that I have that physical allergy. You know, when I put alcohol into my body, it supersedes everything, and I can't stop. I can't stop once I get it in me, and that's, like, in any form. And I'm very cautious now. I don't even eat foods that have alcohol that's been cooked down. It's like I'm just not willing to risk it, you know. what ended up happening then that summer is I'm noticing there's a problem. You know, I'm drunk driving with my kids in the car. There was a scene where I took them to the gym, and I was just so out of it all the time, whether I was drunk or not. I was just out of it, just, like, so self-obsessed and miserable, just, like, this misery. And I remember taking my kid out of the car seat and his G-tube ripping out, and because I was just so out of it, you know, and I had to bring him to the emergency room. And so anyway, you know, I ended up coming – my last week – I ended up noticing – I don't know how to phrase this. I'm finally at work. I keep a job through all this. I have no idea how, because I'm coming to work having been out till like 4 in the morning. I'm wearing clothes that like a 33-year-old woman, a mother of two, should not be wearing. And I'm working at this place, and I just, you know, just a hot mess. And one day I'm in the bathroom, and I was so miserable. I was like shaking, and it was just like the series of events that week. I remember walking into my psychiatrist's office, and I heard somebody share this recently, and I'm like, I cracked up so hard because it was me. I remember just losing it in front of him and just telling him, you know, like, I've done this. I really wanted Valium, so I kept trying to fight for that. And I was like, you know, I'm not getting my money's worth. And I was so angry. And you know, and, you know, I did. I finally, like, one day in the bathroom at work, I was just so, like, in the pit of misery. I remember being in the bathroom, like, God, help me. Just God, help me. I didn't know what to do. And I don't mean to be dramatic, but if there had been a way for me to kill myself in the bathroom at that moment, I would have done it. I fantasized about suicide 24/7. And I just knew I couldn't get away from myself. I was stuck, and I wouldn't kill myself because I was scared to do that. It's like, I can't even do that right. Like, you know, if I jump off a bridge, I'll just be paralyzed. Like, I mean, there's nothing, you know, I'm stuck. And my daughter had a preschool graduation a few weeks later, and I don't know, it just hit me during that graduation when they were showing pictures of the children. When I saw her picture, just out of nowhere, it just hit me that I didn't know I was an alcoholic or anything, but it hit me that my drinking was a problem, finally. I'd seen it. I knew it was a problem. I knew, but I didn't know, you know. And I just started crying, and I told my ex-husband, I said, I think I'm a drunk. I think I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to go to AA meetings. And he was like, I'm really proud of you. So I started going to AA meetings. You know, I called my brother who's in the program, and he gave me some women's phone numbers and kind of made some suggestions about what meetings had a solution. And I'm like, no, I've got this. Where I would tell him I was calling somebody, and I know I'm going to call a soul, nobody. And I went to meetings. Like, I would show up when the meeting started, and I would leave when the meeting ended. And I wasn't doing anything. You know, I didn't really have a sponsor. I didn't have a home group for sure. And what I was hearing was, I was hearing people share, and this isn't how people probably meant it, but what I was hearing was people would say, I used to have a drinking problem. Now all these crazy things happened. I'm not drinking anymore. And now I have a life beyond my wildest dreams. And I remember sitting there thinking, okay, well, it just started making me really mad. I'm like, well, I'm like just as physically sober as you are, but I'm not okay. I'm worse. You know? And so I decided, you know, well, I have to drink. I have to. Like, that's the difference between me and you. I have to drink. And, you know, so I started drinking again, like, I'm not even 30 days, you know, and now I just became a liquor drinker, and I was doing all these things to control it. Like, I'm only going to get two tall airplane bottles from the ABC store, and that's all I'm going to drink tonight. Those will be done in 15 minutes. Now I'm drunk driving to the gas station to get beer. It was just chaos. It was just chaos and confusion, and I'm miserable. I'm crying. Like, I can't even go shopping. I remember being, like, going to buy my kids' clothes at a consignment shop and just bursting into tears in front of the woman at the cashier, just bursting into tears. And she's like, do you need a hug? I mean, this is like a mess, and I had no friends. And, you know, finally, the last weekend, like, my last final weekend bender, I had no plan to quit drinking that weekend. I had the kids that last weekend. I drank through the whole weekend from the minute I got off work till the, you know. And my very last drink was a Corona. It was the last thing I could scrounge up in my fridge. And I drank that Sunday night, and I just passed out. And that weekend, too, I remember, I think, you know, I, you know, again, remember my son can't eat or drink, and I actually told, it was like Saturday at like 6 at night, and I told my daughter, I said, I'm just going to run to the gas station real quick because I needed wine. You stay here with Doc, my son, and don't tell your daddy that I left you because he'll put mommy in jail. And I went to the guys, left them alone. So when I woke up that Monday morning, I mean, I mean, I deserve to be left up for that. And I always think that, and I always remember that when people tell me that I'm doing too much in AA, I need a break, you know, well, you deserve to go on vacation. You deserve, like, we're going to the river this week and you deserve it. I don't deserve anything. If life is a process of getting and taking what I deserve, then I deserve to be locked up, seriously, either in jail or some mental institution. Like, that's what I deserve. So, you know, when I came back that last night, I drank that Corona, last thing I could find, passed out, woke up in the morning, and I was shaking and terrified, and I just wanted to sink into the floor. I'm like, these poor kids, they'd be better off if I was dead. You know, I just knew, I'm going to destroy their lives because everything I've touched, I've already ruined their lives. They have divorced parents now, and they're between homes, and this happy vision I had is gone. I've just caused so much destruction in all areas of my life, like my friendships, my job was suffering, and I just wanted to die. And I remember calling my brother, and I was just like, you know, I just told him that I'd been drinking again, and he gave me this woman's phone number, and finally, he'd been giving me numbers, and I finally called her. He's like, you call her, and then call me right back when you get her. And so she and I, we touched base for a little bit throughout the day, and we finally got in touch, like we were leaving voicemails. And I always wish I had a recording of that first 911 call, because I was like, just left this crazy message. I was crying and hysterical. I'm like, I need help. I can't stop drinking, and please help me. And she wanted to meet with me that night. She wanted to take me to a meeting, and I told her, well, I'm actually meeting with a new therapist tonight. when I say I exhausted every option, I'm not kidding. I did not want to come here. I don't know why. I think for, like, it freaked me out that it was in churches. I don't know. I don't know what I thought AA was, but I knew I didn't want it. And so, I went to go see that therapist that night, and I finally unloaded. For the first time, I was truthful in a therapist and doctor's office about my patterns of drinking, what I've been doing, everything. And then her response to me, she said, you need to be in rehabilitation. Like, I can't see you anymore. I can't do anything for you. There's nothing I can do. And I just walked out of there just like, and I called that woman again, the woman that would become my first sponsor. And I just told her, I'm done. I'll go to the meeting with you Tuesday. So the next day at work, so I haven't been to my meeting yet. Now I'm at work Tuesday morning. And I remember I spent the entire day researching on the internet how to kill myself. I mean, I knew what I was facing. I knew that I couldn't drink anymore, and I knew I couldn't not drink. And I was only in there for a day, and it was a very terrifying place to be. I just was out of my mind, and I was on four different medications finally when I came in here, and I found the one that was a sedative, and I looked up how much I needed to take to go into cardiac arrest, and I'm like, okay, I'm in. And but then I kept reading. This is probably God doing for me what, you know, I can't do for myself. I kept reading, and it went on to say what happens to your body after death, and you defecate yourself after you die. And I'm like, oh, no. So I'm so concerned what I look like, even in death. So, you know, I went to the meeting, and I met this woman, and, you know, I just was not impressed, you know. I knew she was sober a long time, but she was really earthy, and she was talking to me about gardening, and I'm all up in my head, and I hate gardening, but I hated myself more than I hate gardening. And she invited me to Starbucks after, and when we were driving, I called my brother, and I said, you know, I don't know her, but I'm just going to ask her to sponsor me. Like, is that okay? Is that, like, poor etiquette? And, like, there was, like, silence on the phone. I thought I'd hung up on him, and I'm like, hello? And he said, Sarah, that is the best idea you have ever had in your life. And he said, you do what she says or you're going to die. And I did. I asked her at Starbucks, and she 12-stepped me. Are you willing to go any lengths? And yes, I was. And that's where my recovery kicked off. And I'm very lucky. I really lucked out. That was like the biggest God shot of all time, because she ended up just luckily being a woman who lives and breathes by this stuff and really practice this program the way it's supposed to be done. I mean, she's constantly with new women and just working with others and just very principled in all her affairs. I mean, she's just amazing. Like, I want to be just like her someday. And we're still very close. You know, she's no longer my sponsor. And that's only because I didn't realize how alcoholic I was until, like, more time went on not drinking. And, you know, I just thought I went from doing, like, 75% of her suggestions to, like, 25% and getting super edgy and hanging up on her. And I knew that I was killing myself. I'm like, I can't do this. I need somebody. And I picked a sponsor that intimidates me, that I just naturally defer to for whatever reason. Whatever reason it is about this woman, I just naturally listen and defer to her. And what I have found is, like, I just keep getting re-desperate. Before I asked her, I wasn't even thinking about asking her to sponsor me, but one night I was so off the rails, and me in untreated alcoholism is so not pretty. It's like, I feel like I'm completely unhinged from reality or something, and the anxiety is just, oh my God. And I remember I went to bed one night, and I was clutching my white chip, and I passed out, and I went to sleep, and I was like, you know, when I said a prayer, I was like, God, I don't even know what to pray, just good night. And I woke up the next morning, and I'm still clutching my white chip, like my body hadn't even relaxed. And, you know, and they say when the student is ready, the teacher will appear, and this woman that became my second sponsor just randomly was appearing in my life in all these weird places. Like, she was at a baby shower I was at, and we did a 12-step call together, and that was a really powerful experience, because I have done a formal 1 through 12, and of course the numbers fall off of those, may become things we practice in our daily lives, and that's so important to me. I mean, I really try to live and breathe by this, because I am very cognizant that I need a spiritual solution, because what this book tells me, you know, it says, you know, in the very first cover, it says, the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. My first assignment was to read, you know, she got me into the book immediately. After that, after she 12-stepped me, we were reading within, like, that week. I mean, we had a set schedule, you know, she got me into the book. Like, you know, I'm not raised in, like, kooky feelings, AA, like, what are you feeling? You know, I'm in solution, you know, because that's what I need, and I want to recover from alcoholism, because my first assignment was to read Bill's story, and what really opened my eyes in that, you know, she's like, I want you to highlight everywhere where you thought, felt, and drank like Bill Wilson, and I did that, and, like, a lot, like, you know, of course, there's this thought stuff that I don't identify with, but, I mean, most of it was yellow. I'm like, oh my God, is that alcoholism? So when I got to step one, it was a breeze. Like, I'm like this man, basically. I think and drink and feel like him. Oh my God. And I have all these weird characteristics that he had. Like, you know, that stimulus augmentation, you know. Sorry, that means that you make mountains out of molehills. You know, that's me. And I'm hypersensitive. And what this life is teaching me now, and I'm just, again, I feel so lucky. I feel so lucky to be here with you guys. I mean, I feel like AA is turning my heart from, like, this creepy little raisin into, like, this big, like, you know, because I tell my friends all the time, like, I'm just like, I love you. Like, I don't mean to interrupt what you're saying, but I just want you to know that I freaking love you. And I just, like, I get so overwhelmed with happiness sometimes. And then my sponsor and I joke, I'm like, oh, it's just, don't worry about me, I'm bipolar. And, you know, so we have this joke that I'm like this pendulum, and she assures me that as more sobriety goes on, and as long as I stay in the solution, that'll even out. And the biggest thing for me is I just, you know, I have this job now, you know. What's funny is I thought, because I came in here, I don't know, I just really thought that not drinking would be okay for me, but as an alcoholic, we all know, you know, that's not what happens. But I know that, you know, unless I adopt a spiritual solution, what's going to happen, if I don't practice these things in my affairs, I'm going to eventually need something to take the edge off, because it's progressive. I can die an alcoholic death. It doesn't have to be alcohol consumption. I could have a heart attack at 1 year sober, a nuclear meltdown. I could just get into an accident because I'm so out of my head, and that's how I get. I mean, again, that untreated alcoholism with me, like, I ran into a wall at work. I just, like, walk and smack, bump into it. Like, I just become, like, I'm like a Fruit Loop, you know, and I'll run red lights, and I'll just do all the, like, I forgot to feed my cat for 3 days, and it attacked me. But, you know, like, more and more, I'm just feeling, and it happens, and I'm learning to appreciate being in the stream of life. Like, to me, heaven for me is just, like, being normal. And just realizing, like, God, I just went 2 hours. I didn't think about myself once. Like, I was just working, and I'm happy. And it's been this shift now. You know, I recognize now it's like I'm having to turn my life and my will over to the care of God as I understand Him. And for me, what that looks like is just adopting a life of service, like an attitude of servitude, just taking me out of the equation. Like, what I define my recovery as is, like, this death of self. You know, it's just like death of self. And it says it in the St. Francis prayer, you know, it is in giving that we receive. It is in pardoning that we are pardoned. It is by dying to self that we are born into eternal life. And that's what I want. To me, eternal life is here. It's not in heaven when I die. It's here and now. Like, I get one life, and I want to be in it. I want to be in the stream of it. I don't want to be miserable. I'm tired of it. It's no way to live. It's not how God wanted me to live. When I'm miserable, everybody around me is miserable, and it's just not pretty. It is not. I have a very strong fellowship of women. I'm very active. I have a lot of play dates with other moms in recovery, you know. And I feel so lucky and blessed, you know, because I have a little something extra special. Like, I have a brother in the program, and that, you know, if it wasn't for him, like, I don't know. I don't know that I would have gotten this, you know. He's not responsible for my sobriety or anything, but I just feel so blessed with that gift. And he spoke today at a meeting in Richmond, and I just remember I was just so overwhelmed. Like, I love this man so much, I think I'm going to explode. Like, you know, and I was nervous speaking here with him tonight because, like, I still kind of always want his stamp of approval. But as I get more well, like, that's becoming less and less. And we have this really awesome relationship. You know, being in recovery with a brother is great. And, you know, and because of him, you know, he has a reputation in Richmond. But, you know, he's really well-respected, and he has a really strong program, and I couldn't get 13th stepped if I tried, so, you know, I've been safe from that. So it's just been a really good year. You know, I have, like, close friendships with women, and we actually really love each other, and I actually care about what's going on in people's lives. I mean, for me, that's tremendous. So thank you so much again. Thank you.